been recorded if it hadn't been for what they were accused of.
Presents BBC Radio 4's major new series.
People were so obsessed by the scandalous element about it, they lost sight of what they were actually supposed to be doing.
Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley.
So much about the lives of the women we've investigated still rings true today.
Available now on BBC Sounds.
It's midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the fashion designer and artist Osman Yousefzadeh.
Osman Yousefzadeh shot to fame when Beyoncé wore one of his designs to the 2013 Grammy Awards. Lady Gaga, Tandiwe Newton and Taylor Swift are amongst his many other celebrity clients. Osman's an acclaimed artist, designer, filmmaker, writer and curator. You might have been lucky enough to see his spectacular wrapping of the Selfridges building in Birmingham in geometric patterns inspired by Islamic art. It was one of the world's largest ever pieces of public art. Educated at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies, Central St. Martin's and Cambridge University, Osman grew up in a strictly religious immigrant Pashtun community in Birmingham. His newly published memoir, The Go-Between, is an absolutely fascinating account of growing up in this community and his first steps into the world beyond it, while attempting to navigate both racism and family expectations. Osman, I want to talk a lot more about your childhood, your career, but first let's get on to the music and the role it plays in your life. The first piece you brought today is from Abida Parveen, the Pakistani singer known as the Queen of Sufi, Sufi being a form, of course, of Islamic mysticism. Was this something you heard as you were growing up?
Music was quite discouraged or wasn't really allowed when I was growing up. I mean, my brother listened to it in secret in his car. But then when I moved to London, I started experiencing other sort of elements of part of my heritage, my culture, which kind of came forward, and which was less restrictive, less religious, and it just had many different layers. And that's why I kind of got myself lost in. This piece is Amir Khusro. I mean, he is supposed to be the father of the Qawwali, and it's sung by Abida Parveen. And she is, I mean, she's phenomenal. When you listen to her voice, it actually transports you somewhere else. It kind of makes basically my hair sometimes actually stand on my skin. She's actually Sindhi from the south of Pakistan, and she's female, but her voice actually sometimes sort of crosses over, and you don't sometimes know whether it's a male voice or a female voice, you know. And she sings this song, which is "You've taken everything from me, child, to luck." So it's this world which is really kind of transportative. You don't really care what's around you and who's around you. It just takes you somewhere else, basically. It takes you out of yourself, or takes you again into yourself.
Lagi लागे तो जब जानिए जब रहे गुरु के संग मौला खेली पी के संग जीत गई तो पिया मारे जो मैं हारी पी के संग
तिलक सब जी
Taken Everything From Me by Looking Into My Eyes, a ghazal written and composed by the 14th century mystic Amir Khusro and performed by Abid Parveen with Rahat Fateh Ali Khan. Osman Yousafzadeh, your parents came to Birmingham from the Pakistan-Afghan border region. Your father, Tolya, came in the 60s to work as a carpenter, and your mother, Palwashe, followed him a few years later. The community that you were born into, now in the 70s, you call it in the book a slum, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, it's seen as a ghetto now. I think it's basically also, if you read the Daily Mail or even the New York Times, they've labelled it as the jihadi capital of England. So now you have like a very Muslim ghetto in this area, which is still very kind of quite inward looking. And it's an area which doesn't necessarily want to be documented.
It was a very religious upbringing, wasn't it? You went to the mosque every day.
This is actually the 80s when what's called the deindustrialization of the North and Mrs. Thatcher is blamed for closing down all the factories and all these guys who don't necessarily were doing all the work that no one wants to do, and they come home with their redundancy papers, and most of them are illiterate in any language in their mother tongues, or as my parents were. So they decide that, you know, there was a vacuum there. There was a vacuum there of what is our identity now? We've lost the reason we kind of came to this country. And I think that vacuum was very much filled in this idea of religion that, or a religious identity which came to the forefront.
How did it make you feel, that sort of compartmentalization as depicted in, for example, the Daily Mail, especially following 9/11?
I get racially profiled quite regularly, less so now. I mean, I think less so now because I haven't traveled very much because of COVID. But I remember a really strong incident. Apart from, you know, you get pulled aside and especially in America. But then there was one particular incident when I was catching the Eurostar to Paris just after Fashion Week, trying to sell my collection in Paris. You know, I was really excited. Beyoncé had just worn my jumpsuit. So I was taking this new collection over to Paris, and then I had a Pakistani visa in my passport. I'd just taken my mum to visit her parents, and my grandparents were actually unwell. But I was stopped because of this visa that I had in my passport, and then it just became kind of sort of more and more ominous. So I was locked up in a room, and then I was told, you know, I mean, it was quite sort of like, it was really surreal. Looking back upon it, it sort of really seems kind of like as if it was in a Homeland kind of episode. So he was asking me about, you know, how much I earned, what I did, and then he left me for an hour. And so I missed all my trains. I missed a couple of trains. And then I got really upset at one stage. And he goes, well, you know, if you don't, I have the right to actually lock you up for 14 days without an arrest warrant. And then this was actually, so it was kind of quite, yeah, it just seems very surreal now, but where the world becomes kind of quite hostile towards you in a way, just because of either of your name or the way you look.
Mm. Music by Philip Glass now. And what is it that entrances you about this music?
I love Philip Glass. I think he is a really a beautiful minimalist. And I think these etudes, and number two is actually just kind of a minimalism. It's quite hypnotic and a bit of a lullaby. So it still makes you feel like you're present and you're kind of like you're moving along with it rather than it transports you always sometimes.
Thank you.
Jeremy Denk playing the Etude No. 2 by Philip Glass. Your memoir, Osman Yousafzadeh, is above all, I think, a love letter to your mother, Palwashe. She was married at 14, had her first child at 15. She never learned to read or write. She was almost never allowed to leave the small terraced house you grew up in. And she wasn't even allowed to inhabit all of the house. In fact, she had to stay behind a curtain in the women's quarters if a man who wasn't a close relative was visiting. And she was also the victim of a pretty constant domestic violence, wasn't she?
Yeah, my father was quite a complicated man. And as a child, I was quite scared of him. And I think as I grew older, then I felt that I could have understood him more. But he was a man of his own times. He was a lot older than my mum. And also he was like a push and a shove and a slap was another form of language. If he didn't really understand anything, or it didn't really necessarily go his way. But, you know, in contrast, he was also a provider. We had a house that was never empty of food. But then there was a sense of also of entitlement of that everyone had to kind of listen to him. So, yeah, it was kind of quite complicated. I think as my parents kind of like aged, they kind of really understood each other. And then I think my mum had more of the voice later on in life. So she wouldn't sort of like stand for any nonsense. So it was this kind of reversal of roles.
Yes, very interesting. She was clearly a woman of enormous warmth. And also, this is probably very germane to what you then went on to do, she was a hugely talented seamstress, wasn't she?
Yeah. So she was a maker. You know, there was so that the house would be like cushions and embroideries and sort of like curtains and then also, you know, clothes for very many people. My first sister-in-law and her had her business together, and it was a kind of, it was really like a centre. When every time I came in, not only was my mum always wanting to feed people, it was very much like an open kitchen, an open place for people to come and make stuff and cook together. It was a community. And as a kid, I had a pass. I could kind of travel between these worlds of men and the worlds of women and into the outside world. And also, you know, the women who couldn't go out, I was their kind of like their shopper. So I'd go out and buy their shoes and go out and sort of match basically threads for embroideries or laces or haberdasheries.
Yes, it's fascinating, that world of female friendships that you clearly enjoyed very much. But at the age of 12, of course, you had to leave your mother's world and join the man's world on the other side of the curtain, didn't you?
Yeah, so after the age of 12, after when I hit puberty, it wasn't easy to actually inhabit that world anymore, the world of women.
In many ways, the dark heart of the book is the story of your sisters, because as soon as they reached 11 or 12, they were taken out of school and shut away inside the family home, weren't they?
This was of a particular time. This was the 80s and part of the 90s. Fundamentally, they were denied education. So my sisters particularly, they ended up wearing like a burqa from the age of 11. So they went out very rarely. My dad was still drawing child benefit, but then my sisters weren't really going to school. And then there was always a threat of actually being found out. So it was a bit of a cat and mouse. Not that the local authority was actually that efficient at that time.
Let's hear some more music from the Pakistani diaspora now, from Aruj Aftab, the Grammy Award-winning Brooklyn-based Pakistani singer, who, like Abida Parveen, draws inspiration from the Sufi tradition, as well as from jazz, pop and contemporary classical music. What is this song about?
It says, breathe, take a breath, basically sans law. It's quite meditative. I love kind of transportative sounds, and I think it's beautiful again. I mean, I think for us is we've had since 9/11, we've had so much of a kind of like that we don't necessarily have anything really to offer the world sometimes. That all we offer is the world is actually terrorism, or we offer the world conversations of sort of ultra-orthodoxness. But I think these are kind of voices that need to be celebrated. And I think there's these kind of themes of, grief, longing, kind of meditation. She has a beautiful voice that needs to be celebrated.
Haseen chehre
Aru Javtab with music from her 2021 album, Vulture Prince. There's a quality of yearning in the voice, isn't there, Osman?
Oh, my God, yeah. She is so transportative and there's this kind of... It just speaks from the heart.
What was your parents' reaction when you said you wanted to leave Birmingham and go to university in London?
I think to get in was actually really quite impressed. Yeah, they wanted me to go and either become a doctor or become something which was kind of accepted. You know, my parents had actually sacrificed so much for their children's... Well, I think, you know, I had the male privilege in contrast to my sisters. So, I mean, I wanted to go away. And so there'd been a couple of people who'd gone away already from the community. So they'd actually paved the way, but I never came back.
And how was it for you arriving in London and this completely different world?
Well, I came to study kind of South Asian studies and anthropology, but I told my parents that I was doing business studies and they couldn't read my paper, so I just kind of like, I'd signed all my papers with my dad's signature. I'd basically come into a world which was probably quite academic. I mean, I have an academic streak, but I'd come from a very conservative background, so I just kind of went completely crazy. I just sort of found clubs I wanted to go to, dress up, hang out with people, sleep with who I wanted to, wake up when I wanted to. So it was a world from one extreme to another extreme. In that sort of way, I just kind of like felt this personal freedom. So it was a bit of a journey.
Did you downplay your background when you were trying to get started in the fashion world?
So some of the advice I got was that, you know, Osman, don't focus too much on your heritage because everyone's much more interested. You're a really great tailor and there's not really much of an interest on that side of what you do, but this is what you should really focus on. So it was this real kind of like denying your heritage, but then just trying to actually be a sort of like a great tailor and then... always thinking how I can marry both of those kind of parts. But I think the fashion world is quite an elite world as well. It has many barriers in itself. It says that it doesn't, but it does. And I think what I've done with the book is kind of quite important for me because what it's done is it's given me a a clean slate. I don't really have to lie or code switch or, you know, I'm happy to say that my parents are illiterate now. There was a time where I thought, you know, I had to make up stories about them of a different kind of world because my world was so extreme. Even from people of similar racial backgrounds, that my world was actually much more different than theirs. But now I just feel that I've just told all of these stories and I've put them out there, and then I can use that as a platform for my art making.
Mm. This next music from the blind Malian duo Amadou and Mariam reminds you, I suspect, of those student days in London.
So I had a friend called Zara at university, and she introduced me to kind of Afro Blue. This is amazing, actually. I've got a sort of translation of Je pense à toi, and what it translates to is, I think of my love, my beloved, don't leave me, my love, my dear. When I'm in my bed, I dream only of you, and when I wake, I think only of you. I mean, it's kind of quite amazing that not only their bodies, but then it's also their voices actually unites them.
C'est un temps promis.
Amadou and Mariam with Je Pense à Toi. And you can find details of all the music chosen today by my guest, Osman Yousafzadeh, if you visit the Private Passions webpage. And if you search in BBC Sounds, you can find hundreds of previous editions, which you can download and enjoy at your leisure. In 2021, you embarked on what you described as a brand reset, a radical shift to environmentally sustainable fashion. What exactly have you done with your business then?
What I've done is actually I have an interdisciplinary practice. I make clothes sometimes. I make art sometimes. I write sometimes. I try and tell the same story across many different mediums. That's what I really trying to do. So I don't really like to have this kind of very conventional idea of, in the fashion world, it's always about seasonality. Like, what's next? What's next? What do you need to wear in the summer, and what do you need to wear for spring, and what do you need to wear for autumn, winter, or what do you need to wear for pre-fall? So there's this kind of like continuum of how do you marry commerce and purpose within the kind of design and the fashion world. But then I think for me, it's always just having conversations and trying to find meaning in stuff, really. And I think that's where I feel much more comfortable in.
Music now from the Canadian composer and cellist Zoe Keating. I think you've used her music in one of your catwalk shows.
Yeah, I used her for one of the catwalk shows. And again, I think you probably can tell from the list of music that I've actually brought to you guys today is everything is kind of quite transportative. And I quite like the fact that she does something very simple, but she does it with one instrument and she layers it and there's a computer involved, but she builds layers and layers. It's kind of phenomenal that it's just like everything is done. This atmosphere is built with just with one instrument. And of course, they help with technology. Thank you.
The cellist and composer Zoe Keating performing music from her 2005 piece, Exurgency. Osman Yousafzada, you've written about the devastating effect of COVID on your family's community in Birmingham. An astonishing 70 people you knew have died, and several members of your immediate family were in intensive care and very nearly didn't survive.
My sister was in intensive care, and that was kind of like, really, my sister's not even like, you know, my sister's in her 40s. And it was just kind of quite crazy. I mean, just to sort of, I felt that there was this biblical moment just happening where everything just stopped. And I was there and we just had to say goodbye to her before she just went into intensive care. And I still remember actually on a WhatsApp video call, I mean, it was just like, God, is she going to come out or not? I mean, there's kind of conversations that, you know, there's many intergenerational families. A lot of these guys actually work in healthcare, are frontline workers, so they're much more exposed. And then they kind of come bring it back. But I don't know, who knows basically why it happened. But I do think there's always kind of the relationship with poverty and kind of disease and those who get affected by it much more.
Tragically, your mother, Palwashe, died at the beginning of 2022. She was such a big influence on your life and work. And I wonder what the world must feel like now without her.
She's left a huge gap in my life, basically. And, you know, it's still quite early days. And, you know, I still kind of like go on thinking that I can just call her now. And I can't bear to look at any of my photo. My iPhone just pops up some of these memories sometimes. And generally, you know, I was kind of like the last few years when I was looking after her, there'd be lots of, we'd take lots of photos together. So the space and the time that we have on this earth, and then you're just gone and that mouth doesn't speak anymore. And those relationships just kind of like, I just cut.
Well, it's the importance of words that you've chosen in memory of your mother, because you've chosen to play as part of the Quran now, haven't you? It's the Al-Mulk, the 67th chapter. Tell us what these words mean.
I don't really know what the words mean, but they're in Arabic. But we're told that you play this regularly, or you recite it regularly, and it keeps you basically in a safe place when you enter the grave, and it protects you from the worst of the grave, basically, because you, when you, as Muslims, you believe that when you enter the grave, your judgment actually starts. So this is an amulet for a safe journey, and I would play this to my mum during her coma. I don't know, I mean, I think sometimes in those moments, actually, you know, rituals and religion actually become more and more important.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Tabarakalladhi biyadihi al-mulku wa huwa ala kulli shay'in. الذي خلق الموت والحياة ليبلوكم أيكم أحسن عملا وهو العزيز الغفور الذي خلق سبع سماوات طباقا ما ترى في خلق الرحمن من تفاوت فارجع البصر هل ترى من فطور ثم ارجع البصر كرتين ينقلب إليك البصر خاسئا وهو حسير ولقد زينا السماء الدنيا بمصابيح وجعلناها الشياطين وأعتدنا لهم عذاب السعير
وللذين كفروا بربهم عذاب جهنم وبئس المصير إذا ألقوا فيها سمعوا لها شهيقا وهي تفور تكاد تميز من الغيظ كلما ألقي فيها فوج سألهم خزنتها ألم يأتكم نذير قالوا بلى قد جاءنا نذير فكذبنا وقلنا ما نزل الله من شيء فكذبنا وقلنا ما نزل الله من شيء إن أنتم إلا في ضلال كبير
Part of the Al-Mulk, the 67th chapter of the Quran, recited by Omar Hisham. And chosen by my guest today, Osman Yusuf Zada, in memory of his mother, Palwashe. Does religion still play an important part in your life?
I'm still a Muslim, but I'm probably much more kind of like Sufi or spiritual and an expanded and also kind of one which accepts many other kind of religions and identities. And I still find solace in ritual, in going to spaces of contemplation, which kind of transport you elsewhere.
And tell me, Osman, what happened to your sisters? How have their lives turned out?
So my older sister, I mean, she... Yeah, I don't know what she'd want me to say. She probably was the most affected and didn't really move on from that world. She ended up being divorced and bringing up her children. But the younger two have done really quite well, the other two. One of them actually became a spin doctor for the Labour Party, running campaigns for the old Attorney General. And she went to university. She left home, she ran away, and she put herself through university. And then my other sister ended up in a marriage which didn't really work out. But it also allowed her to start working. So she worked her way up from a classroom assistant and now she's a university lecturer doing a PhD on honour-based violence. So there's a happy story in all of that adversity.
When your father died in 2019, 3,000 people came to pay their respects. Looking back, how do you feel about him now?
I mean, I think when I was growing up, my dad was quite scary. But as I grew older, I kind of like, you know, I kind of understood him. He had quite a tragic story himself. You know, his father, he was orphaned at the age of 10. I mean, most of the time until adulthood, he was barefooted. He got himself all the way to the other side of the world and built a new life, like someone who couldn't read or write. So I really admire him a lot. I think my journey would be actually very different if it wasn't for him. And he was a man who... He didn't have the codes to be able to kind of integrate either. So they created all a world for themselves. You know, they couldn't kind of read or write. And then there was a world that they didn't really know.
That's very interesting because I was just about to observe that the one word that you have used in respect of almost every piece of music is transports, that music transports you, takes you out of yourself. And I wonder if that's true of the final song from Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, the Pakistani singer who was most famous, I suppose, for singing in the Qawwali, a form of Sufi devotional music.
I mean, this is probably one of the first songs that I really fell in love with. There was a girlfriend who introduced me to this song and... It's beautiful, it's repetitive, and it's not a Muslim devotional song, even though most of the Qawwalis are actually Muslim. The original version is actually a Hindu dedication to Lord Krishna by Mirabai. So a poetress from, I don't know when, probably 15th, 16th century. Very much what I love is these kind of inter-religion and cultures which actually cross different boundaries, and, you know, they feed into each other. And I think that was actually really the beauty of the subcontinent for most of its existence, where you had Hinduism and you had Islam, and out of that came Sikhism, and there was this whole world which actually just layered, and the colouring of Islam took on different kind of like forms as it sort of like spread throughout the world. And it's something that I don't think we should really try and lose in these conversations of purifying what Islam is, because it's a relationship with you, the Almighty.
That's a lovely note on which to finish as we listen to this music. So it only remains for me, Osman Yusuf Saada, to thank you very much for bringing us this music and indeed your private passions.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, guys.
Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan with On the Rosary of Breath by Mirabai, a 16th century mystic poet. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Osman Yousafzadeh. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. You can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds. The programme returns next Sunday at noon when Michael Barclay will be talking to the late children's author and illustrator, Shirley Hughes. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock and time for the news with me, Jane Royce. Russia says 46 civilians were moved from the devastated port of Mariupol yesterday. It's claimed they left a residential area near a steelworks that's become the last bastion of Ukrainian resistance in the city. The Russian Ministry of Defence has released a video apparently showing people leaving in buses, with vehicles from both the Red Cross and the United Nations present. The UN hasn't confirmed the details of the operation. The Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, has led a group of American politicians in a visit to the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. Meeting President Volodymyr Zelensky, Ms. Pelosi said the country was fighting for everyone's freedom and that the US would back its resistance against Russian aggression until the fight is done. The business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, has insisted that Parliament is a safe place for women to work, despite what he called a few bad apples. There have been a string of bullying and sexual misconduct claims in Westminster in recent weeks. Yesterday, the Conservative, Neil Parish, resigned after admitting he'd watched pornography in the Commons twice. The Parliamentary Standards Committee is to release a new code of conduct for MPs in the coming weeks. The chairman of Asda, Lord Rose, has warned of further increases to food prices as inflation takes hold in the UK. He says extra pressures are being caused by the war in Ukraine and further COVID lockdowns in China. The latest estimates show the cost of living hit a 30-year high of 7% in March. British expats in Spain are reportedly facing a driving ban after the government failed to reach a post-Brexit deal to ensure their UK licences were valid. Anyone who's lived there for more than 6 months will now have to have a Spanish licence and may need to retake a driving test. The Foreign Office said it was hoping to resolve the situation. A tradition's returned to Washington with the resumption of the glitzy annual White House Correspondents' Dinner, the first since the outbreak of COVID. Joe Biden attended the function, which customarily lampoons the incumbent president. His predecessor, Donald Trump, repeatedly shunned the event. And the weather today, England and Wales will be overcast with patchy rain. Scotland and Northern Ireland, some brighter spells developing. BBC News.
Ralph Vaughan Williams, countryman and radical, serviceman and activist, folk song collector and symphonist.
I think he's one of the most important 20th century symphonists.
To celebrate his 150th anniversary year, I'm joined by experts to build up a comprehensive portrait of a composer who's left an indelible mark on British music.
I really do believe that Vaughan Williams' music is in fact more relevant than ever.
See Vaughan Williams in a